Did you know 64% of employers added a family building benefit because an employee asked for it? No matter the size of your organization, you have the power to make a difference for current and future employees. Want to know where to start? Progyny is here to help. Progyny is a family building benefits company that has been helping employees and employers advocate for increased access to effective and equitable fertility and family building benefits for over 7 years. To get the resources that can help you make a difference, visit progyny.com/talktohr today. For this episode, we partnered with Needed, the leading women's health supplement brand recommended by nutritionally trained practitioners. Did you know that 95% of women who take prenatals are still nutrient deficient? Most prenatals are designed to meet bare minimum needs, not to optimally nourish you. We love that Needed's products are based on the latest clinical research and that they focus on care before, during, and after pregnancy. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.
You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. I am Dr. Carrie Bedian from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas, and I am joined by my two fantastically fantabulous, sorry, can't come up with another F word. It's been a long day.
That's probably a good thing.
The only F words that I can come up with are probably terribly inappropriate, and I know that we're uncensored, but I feel like that's kind of a rough way to start off an episode. So I'm joined by Dr. Abby Eblin of Nashville Fertility Center.
Hey, everybody.
And Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
Hello, everyone.
How are you guys doing on this beautiful post-clinic evening?
It's good. You know, we usually record a little earlier in the day than we are right now. So I think we're a little crazy, but that's all good.
Yeah, all the brain cells aren't quite firing for me right now. So hopefully they'll wake up a little bit as we go along.
Well, Susan, you just scarfed dinner, and I'm assuming Abby, you may or may not have eaten yet if you just gawked in. And I
certainly I got takeout on the way home because my husband had something to do tonight, so I just got takeout on the way home. So I scarfed it too, but I didn't scarf as quickly as Susan. I don't think I had a little time.
So I am currently obsessed with food because I'm starving and I haven't eaten dinner yet. And so, what is the best, most memorable dining experience you've had? Where was it? Why was it so memorable?
What makes I've got it? A good one. I've got a good okay. one.
You go, Susan.
You go.
So my most memorable dining experience was probably about 15 years ago in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And my husband and I had gone to Emeralds.
Mm-hmm. And oh, wow.
We were, you know, young and, you know, going to go see everything. And as some of y'all may know, I have celiac, so I have to eat gluten-free food. And eating gluten-free food right now in 2024 is so much easier than it was 15 years ago, especially in New Orleans.
Is it? Where
everything's fried or bread or roux. And so I had been struggling a little bit when we were there, and we had made reservations just to have a special night out. And we walk in, and it was so funny because, like, first of all, you walk in the door and there's people at the hostess stand, and we walk in and they're like, "Hi, Mr. and Mrs. Hudson." Like, we didn't tell them who we were.
Whoa.
But it was like they had a reservation at a certain time and they knew the people walking in were those people. So that was the first thing. I was like, ooh, this is kind of cool. Then we get seated and we, you know, go through and decide what to order. And, you know, I'm trying to be very persistent about, please make sure my food is gluten-free, no cross-contamination, all this type of thing. They're like, no problem, no problem. We've got it taken care of. Well, then they bring out this dish and it had three sauces. Okay. And you guys have eaten with me and you know that sauces are usually kind of scary in my world because
you never know what you're going to get in your sauce, right?
Especially in New Orleans. I'm like, I was like, okay, so you gave me three sauces. Which one can I actually eat? And they're like, oh, no, they're all gluten-free. And I'm like, oh, no, seriously, like, kind of funny, but can y'all go double check this? And they're like, oh, no, it was. And it was everything they served was amazing, wonderful, gluten-free.
Oh, wow.
It was a beautiful, beautiful experience. Well, come to find out, I believe one of Emeril's children has celiac.
Oh, wow.
So they're very, very cognizant. And I didn't know that at this time, but I have since learned this, that they're very cognizant about gluten-free, celiac, and everything like that. And so that was probably one of the most amazing dining experiences of my life. Just everything from the moment we walked into the door. I mean, I even had dessert. I mean, I don't get to have dessert many places.
You never get to eat dessert.
Yeah. Uh-uh. And so
from the woman who is usually eating your dessert.
So, but it was a beautiful experience. What about you guys?
You go, Carrie. What was your most memorable dining experience? You live in Las Vegas. You have lots of potential memorable dining experiences, right?
I do, but none of those are the one that's coming to mind right now. The one that's coming to mind is in, let me think about this, 2017. And it was in like April. And I had just been to Dallas and had just taken my oral boards.
Oh, you deserve a good meal after that one.
Oh, yeah.
So I was, as soon as I could get out of the hotel and get out of the city, I did, because I'm
the Melrose Hotel in Dallas. The Melrose Hotel, right?
Melrose Hotel. And as soon as I could get out, I did, because I'm sure Dallas is a lovely city. But the only two times I've spent any amount of time in there were for board exams.
Yeah.
And so now, like, I drive through or fly through Dallas and I get a little nauseated. And so I got to the airport, and I don't even remember. It was some Mexican restaurant in the airport. And I sat down and I had a huge, I think it was a burrito with sauce. So maybe an enchilada. I don't know. It was some delicious. I don't even remember what it was. I may or may not have ordered a really strong margarita, because I'm like, I'm going to forget this day. And I just remember sitting there being delighted that I was done. And I never eat in airports because it's more expensive. And never, I mean, I had at that point had been a student and a trainee forever and ever. And I felt like I was splurging and I was treating myself, because I got to eat at an airport restaurant and have an adult beverage and just did it. I didn't even look at the prices. I just did it.
It was a well-earned dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's funny that that's what pops up in my brain as a really memorable meal, because
I do remember the overwhelming sense of euphoria and relief when you walk out that door of taking your boards and you're like,
oh,
it's done. Yeah. And there's nothing I can do about it, but it's over. I don't have, hopefully never have to study for this like this ever again.
Yeah. Abby, can you think of anything, or are you?
Well, I was trying to think. One of the more memorable things I can think of is, I remember one time a few years ago, it was like this time of year, like, you know, or it was like January, February, somewhere in there, when it was cold and yucky outside. And I remember on my computer screen came a picture of this town. And I just remember thinking, that is so pretty. It looks like a postcard. I just want to be there. And it was Portofino, Italy. So fast forward a few years ago, we went to the Amalfi Coast, and one of the cities we visited was Portofino, and it is just the most magical place. You just look around, and you're like, I'm walking around in a postcard. This is so cool. And so we ate lunch, and Portofino, most of it is a cart path. I mean, you can't really drive around it. You have to walk everywhere. But when you walk in Portofino, you keep going up, up, and up these winding, you know, beautiful, like, have all these beautiful flowers coming down. And when you get to the top, like, you look down on the beach and you see these little tiny itty bitty red umbrellas. I mean, it's just, you're so high up. It just seems so bizarre that you can look down and see something so tiny that you've walked up or walked from. So anyway, we ate lunch there, and just overlooking the beautiful sea and the little tiny red umbrellas, it felt magical. It was such a cool, and you know, we ate obviously a great meal because it was Italy, the country of Italy. So it was just a really magical time.
That's awesome.
That's fabulous. Good. All right. Well, now that I'm even hungrier, Susan, do we have questions?
We do. Okay. The first one is, hello, love your podcast. Thank you. My question is concerning cervical mucus around the fertile window. I get it a lot, like a lot. I also get it for about a week prior to ovulating. Is too much fertile cervical mucus bad for sperm? My husband has 3% morphology and has slow progressive swimmers. The other numbers are fine. Wondering if the excess of cervical mucus is preventing us from getting pregnant unassisted. Also, is high estrogen to blame for this? How could I control it? I've had one IVF pregnancy, but unfortunately lost my little one at 19 weeks due to structural anomalies. I now ovulate regularly and would like to try to get pregnant without assistance. My prior diagnosis was suspected PCOS, but all other tests were normal. Thank you.
So I would say too much cervical mucus, I don't think is bad. Kind of, it's really a sign that your estrogen level is going up. So it is related to estrogen. And so we do know that estrogen starts to raise, you know, as you get closer kind of to ovulation. And so other than just being kind of a nuisance, and maybe sometimes it can be irritating if you have a lot of moisture in your underwear, it can be really irritating. But it really, I don't think, unless you guys know something different, I don't really think it should impair the ability of the sperm to swim. To the contrary, if the mucus gets thinner, it's easier for the sperm to swim through and swim up in the reproductive tract. So other than being kind of a nuisance to you, I don't think it's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, hostile cervical mucus used to be a thing, but I think it's gotten less and less traction as time has gone on. I mean, the hormonal influence of estrogen and progesterone on cervical mucus helps the little channels align so that the sperm can get through it. And that's part of the reason why sperm being of a particular shape is important, because that helps to streamline through the cervical mucus. But having a lot of it is a lesser problem than having too little of it, because if there's nothing for the sperm to swim through, it can't swim. So I think it's probably a nuisance, but at this point, we don't really have any good way to test it. I mean, you used to do a postcoital test where you have sex.
You never did a postcoital test, Carrie. You never did one. I'm sure of it.
I never did one.
I never did one.
I did.
I listened to you when you talk, and you have
and they done were worthless.
And like, I can't imagine having sex, rushing to the doctor's office.
And I know. Within 4 hours.
And putting your feet up in stirrups and going, all right, doc, check it out.
Testing for spinbark height.
Yes.
How stretchy your cervical mucus is. Yeah. I think, you know, it's one of those things that I think is more bothersome than anything else, and probably doesn't have a lot of implications as to your fertility challenges. All right. One more question. Hi, I'm a 27-year-old with an AMH of 1.4, day 3 FSH of 8, been doing fertility treatments for the past 5 months and been trying for 18 months, never been pregnant. Husband's semen analysis is normal, HSG was normal, done 2 Medicaid cycles with 50 milligrams of Clomid and 3 IUIs with 50 milligrams of Clomid and trigger shot. Each cycle, I produce 2 to 3 follicles. Our current doctor recommends us move on to IVF. I have a few questions. First, should I have done 3 IUIs? Second, is my AMH likely the reason I never have been able to get pregnant? Third, since I responded well to the lowest dose of Clomid, could I expect to respond well to IVF medications? Any advice would be appreciated. Thank you all so much. So, 2 Clomid timed intercourse cycles, 3 IUIs with 50.
She's only 27 years old.
Correct.
So yes, that right there means, nope, you were totally fine doing those IUI cycles, because at best they worked, at worst they didn't. And at worst you are 27 and a half instead of 27 years on the dot. And so you are totally fine having done those, because you don't lose very much by doing them, and you have the potential to gain everything in the world. And so that answer might be different if you were in your 40s, but at 27 you have that luxury of a little bit more time with less anxiety about it. So I think you're probably okay on that one. With respect to responding to medications, it's always reassuring when someone responds to Clomid and gets a couple of follicles like that. I don't think your AMH is too problematic. It's 1.4. It's not like it's 0.4. You know, that's a hair lower than the 1.5 we're looking for. And then maybe 2 to 3 that we would hope to see a 27-year-old at, but that is not desperately low. So I think you're in a very reasonable place. I think you have had reasonable treatment up to now, and that moving to IVF is equally as reasonable given that you haven't gotten pregnant, and give it a shot. And I hope it works beautifully for you.
Yeah, and just remember that even if everything goes perfectly with oral medicine and IUI, it's going to work maybe 10% of the time. So unfortunately, 90% of the time when you do a Clomid IUI cycle, it's not going to work. So just because it hasn't worked in three Clomid IUI cycles doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have a bad outcome with IVF. I mean, you're, like Carrie said, you're 27, and 27-year-olds, even if you didn't have that many eggs, which I think you'll probably do fine based on your AMH, they're still 27-year-old eggs, and those eggs are much, much better than somebody that's several years older than you. They do better. They fertilize better. They grow better, and they just do better overall. So even if you didn't have a high egg yield with IVF, your age is definitely going to be on your side.
Completely agree.
All right. So now that we have gone through our questions, the big topic of today is, drum roll, please, how to choose an REI. And
that's a big question. That's like,
it's huge. It's hard.
It's huge. I mean, it's not necessarily quite as big as who you're going to spend the rest of your life with, but it's who you're going to spend the next several months with.
Or maybe years or two. And you may even come back again to see us down the road.
I have some patients who just emailed me that they were some of my very first pregnancies after I got out of fellowship. And we're now like, I don't know, 9 years, whatever, later. And so you stick with these people for a while. And so first of all, what is REI besides the sporting goods store?
Reproductive endocrinology. So we're board certified in reproductive endocrinology and infertility.
Yes.
So that's what it stands for.
What's reproductive endocrinology? We can all figure out the infertility, but what's reproendo?
It's essentially learning about how the different hormonal systems communicate between your brain, in your uterus, in your ovaries, and all that kind of good stuff. So there's other things that we learn, but it's really looking at the hormonal systems and how they're speaking with each other, which is very valuable, obviously, in what we're doing.
And one of the things, too, that we learn, and not as many people tend to go this direction, but some people do, is we can do reproductive surgery. So sometimes we see, you know, younger patients that have reproductive malformations. We operate on people that have issues related to fertility, like endometriosis and fibroids and things like that. So that's another component of what your fertility doctor can do.
So what's the difference between reproductive endocrinology versus medical endocrinology? Because a lot of people have heard of endocrinologists that manage their diabetes and stuff. So what's the difference between those two types of endocrinology?
So we really start out at different areas. So medical endocrinologists generally do internal medicine as their primary residency, whereas we do OB-GYN, obstetrics and gynecology, as our
OBGYN, that some people say OBGYN or OBGYN, tomato, tomato, or yeah, OBGYN.
There's lots of abbreviations in how we say this. OBGYN, OBGYN.
Yes. Because OBGYN is a drink you get at a bar. Sorry.
We need to make up. Is there really a drink called OB? We need to make one up. That could be our signature, like, fertility dots.
Ooh.
Yeah. That could be our signature drink.
I'm all over that. Come out to Vegas. We'll figure it out.
Okay. So anyway, that's where we all do our, we do different residencies. Okay. Our residency is 4 years. Their residency is generally 3 years. And then we go on to fellowship training. Okay. And there is fellowship training in endocrinology, medical endocrinology. And those are doctors who generally take care of things like diabetes, thyroid disease, Cushing's, diseases of the adrenal glands, things like this. Okay. And then you have us who do reproductive endocrinology and infertility. And we get trained in all those things to some degree, but we really, really specialize in those reproductive glands.
So can you go to a medical endocrinologist and get fertility treatment? And can you come to us and get diabetes or thyroid or whatever treatment?
No and no. So and we yes, like Susan. Yes. we know a little bit about. I think the biggest place, if I had to really think about it, the biggest thing where that we overlap with medical endocrinologists is thyroid. It's very important for
and prolactin.
But I mean, but how much thyroid? How many Synthroid prescriptions do you write versus how many
bajillion
other one? A jillion. So
I don't know. I'm on a cabergoline prolactin kick right now. I'm on like
really?
Fourth prescription in the last 2 weeks.
I have a lot of people with high prolactin too.
Do you? So we do that, but I would say, you know, really thyroid's the one thing that we sort of see together. Although I will definitely say I defer to the medical endocrinologist when people start getting in higher levels of the thyroid hormone that they need, or if they have a thyroid mass or anything like that. Really, mm-hmm. We kind of defer to them. So we know just enough to manage it and, you know, milder cases. But if it tends to be something like hyperthyroidism, that's definitely something we would refer to a medical endocrinologist. Hypothyroidism, underactive thyroid, we kind of manage. But for the most part, our biggest niche is in the reproductive hormones, like Susan said, the ones that are secreted from the brain, FSH and LH, that go down and stimulate the ovaries to make eggs. And that's the world we live in most of the time.
So how are REIs different than regular OB, GYNs, GYNs, or GYNs?
So we did that extra 3 years of training specifically in helping people achieve pregnancy. And so most REIs no longer deliver babies. Okay, that's one of the first questions people ask after they get pregnant. They're like, are you delivering my baby? And most of us do not deliver babies anymore. I think the only REIs I know that deliver babies anymore are in academic institutions. And, you know, we have more time to help deal with those fertility challenges. And also our world revolves around the menstrual period. So a lot of times people are like, well, my period's going to start in 10 days. And it's like, you're going to call us when you start your period. And it's like, but what if I can't get in? And it's like, but everybody who comes to see us is working on their menstrual period. So they're all going to be able to get in. Once you get in for your new patient appointment.
Yeah. The new patient appointment is the hard part.
That's the hard part. After that, it all works out. It really, really does. And so, you know, we have, you know, when you go see your OB-GYN, most of those appointments realistically are going to be maybe 15-minute appointments. And that's probably very generous for most OB-GYN appointments. And it's just because they work on a different schedule than we do. Whereas when we have new patient appointments and follow-up consultations and those types of things, you know, we have the time to sit down and really kind of dive into a lot of those deeper questions, which are really important when you're having your fertility evaluation.
And one of the other things too about our office, because sometimes patients will say, well, I tried to do this in my OBGYN's office and it just didn't work out, or they couldn't get me in for my ultrasound. Our offices, like Susan sort of alluded to, we're set up to take people when they need to be seen, which is usually right around their period or right around ovulation. And so we're set up to be able to do things on the weekends if we need to, like intrauterine inseminations. And we have some OBGYNs in our community that will do IUIs, but on the weekends they're not open. And so so we're set up to handle you 7 days a week for the most part, because your ovulation doesn't just stop on the weekends. So if we're not open on Sundays and a lot or not, we're able to do things like retrievals, egg retrievals, and embryo transfers and things like that. Those things that absolutely have to be done on the weekends, we're able to do those literally 7 days a week.
Receptiva DX is a powerful test that can help detect inflammatory conditions on the uterine lining that might be preventing you from becoming pregnant or staying pregnant. If you've experienced implantation failure or recurrent pregnancy loss, ask your doctor about Receptiva DX testing. If found, uterine inflammation can be treated, providing a new pathway to achieving a successful pregnancy. Receptiva DX. Because the journey's worth it.
So when someone says, oh, I got referred to a urologist, a general urologist, to get my semen analysis done, or my partner is going there, what's the difference between urologists and REIs?
So urologists also did their own type of training, okay? And really, they focus on the system of your kidneys, your bladder, your ureter, your urethra. Essentially, that system is everything that they do. And so they're a great option for a man who's needing to get a semen analysis. Some urologists do semen analyses, some don't. Okay, so if you're thinking about going that route first, check to see if they have those services. And then urologists are great for male factor and helping figure out, you know, is this something that we need medical intervention, surgical intervention, those types of things. However, I'm going to get on my soapbox for a moment, okay? Because whenever we're talking about men and urologists, I'm going to start talking about testosterone. Okay.
Love it.
And right now in the United States, it feels like every man on the planet is getting on testosterone.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, you can get testosterone. It feels like in every like strip shopping center, there's a men's health store that you can go get your testosterone. Testosterone that you take by pills, injections, pellets, creams, figure out some other way to get it into your body. It can decrease your sperm. Okay. And sometimes it can decrease your sperm permanently and sometimes eliminate sperm. So if you have low testosterone and if you are needing help with that, make sure you go see a urologist that has an interest, ideally some additional training in fertility to make sure you're either if you have to take testosterone, that you're taking the other medications with it to help protect how your brain and your testicles talk to each other. Or consider other options like Clomid, which could help you build up your own testosterone levels within your body, which that's okay. But just taking plain old testosterone, it's not good for the swimmers.
Well, one thing I'd say about urologists too, some urologists have subspecialty training in infertility. And I think urologists are just sort of coming on the scene with that. There's not a lot of reproductive urologists out there. But if you have a choice of going to a reproductive urologist, not endocrinologist, that's where you want to go. Because urologists are just like other physicians. You know, sometimes they're really focused on operating on the kidney or really focused on surgical aspects of urology. And maybe you're not quite as interested in hormones and male reproduction. And really, it's more of a hormonal bent if the urologist likes to do that. But I think in most of the towns I've been in, even if there's not a urologist that's subspecialty certified in males and in reproduction, there's usually a urologist in town that's kind of their little niche. And everybody sort of knows who they are and they refer the patients to that person. So I think it's important that if you're seeing a general urologist, make sure you see somebody that's really interested in male fertility, because a lot of times they're not as interested in doing a lot of hormonal tests and studies unless that's really kind of their area of interest in urology.
So once you figured out that you need to see an REI, how do you figure out who's the one to see? Because there are going to be some people who live in areas where there's not an REI anywhere close, or there's only one. And other people are going to live in areas where you sneeze and you hit one. And so how do you figure out which REI is the one for you?
That is a very complicated question. There's no specific right answer, but I think we can give you some ideas of things to consider that will help you figure out who's going to be the right REI for you. One thing, unfortunately or fortunately, is you should probably check out your insurance, okay? Because fertility testing and fertility treatment can be pretty pricey, okay? And more insurances are covering testing and treatment in Texas. And I know it varies regionally. And we can all share kind of what our distribution is. I would say probably most insurances in Texas cover diagnosis, so the testing stuff. And I would say probably now over half of the insurances have some treatment coverage. And that can vary from a little bit to a whole lot. But that's an important thing to look at. So if your insurance does cover it, there are likely reproductive endocrinologists or REIs that are listed on your policy that you would need to probably put at the top of your list.
Yeah, and I would say just the good old word of mouth. I mean, you know, chances are if you're reproductive age, you probably have some friends that have either gone through infertility treatments or going through fertility treatments. I think there's nothing wrong with Google. There's nothing wrong with looking at Yelp reviews. But as we've talked about before, a lot of times the people that put reviews out there are people that are not particularly happy, and it may or may not have anything to do with the expertise or how good their reproductive endocrinologist is. I mean, some people are just unhappy and that's kind of how they vent. And so I'm used to it now, but I used to kind of laugh when this first started a few years ago when I would see people and we would say under our physician information, you know, how did you find us? And I used to laugh when I would see like Google or the internet, and I thought, oh my gosh, I would never pick a doctor through Google or through the internet. But I do think that's more the norm now, but I just think you have to be wary of what you see on the internet, because what you see out there really may not reflect the expertise of your physician, the training of your physician, or, you know, how good they really treat the majority of their patients. And so if you have a friend that's done it, or ask them who they've seen and what kind of experience they had.
So when you are looking for someone, and this is particularly important when you aren't in the medical field, so you don't necessarily have that inherent knowledge of what is a residency and a fellowship and board exams and all that, what are the buzzwords in looking at someone's bio, where they say what they've done training wise and the groups they're a part of and all of those things? Like, what are the key things that you really need to look for an REI to make sure that you're going to someone who's got the credentials you think they have?
So the first thing I would say is make sure they're actually an REI.
Yes.
Okay. Because I even recently was looking at some websites and somebody was talking about themselves being a fertility specialist, mm-hmm. and they were a fertility specialist in their realm. Okay. And their realm happened to be in acupuncture medicine. But I can say when you looked at their initial information, it looked like they were a medical doctor who had reproductive endocrinology training. And that was not the case. So, you know, make sure that they're an MD or a DO, somebody who has a medical degree and has been through training for fertility. I mean, it sounds so basic, but it really is an important part.
Well, and it's hard in this day and age. Sometimes you start looking at things, and like you said, kind of the wording can be confusing. So I've also seen people who say that they're, you know, an OBGYN and they're interested in infertility, and you know, and there's nothing wrong with seeing somebody like that, but you know, if you're going to see that person for donor eggs or donor embryos or for IVF, you know, general OBGYNs are not able to do that. And so you really want to make sure that it's a board certified reproductive endocrinologist. And I was trying to remember on the ASRM website, so the American Society for Reproductive Medicine is sort of our governing body. There's actually an area where you can look for a physician in your state. And so it will list the board certified reproductive endocrinologist in the state that you're in or the state you're interested in. And that will kind of at least be a starting point. You know, it may not be that you pick somebody from that, but that'll at least give you an idea, because there's not that many of us around, actually. There's pretty, you know, a pretty low number. And particularly, even if you're in a larger city, there may be a few, 5 or 6 or 7, but there's not going to be the same number of reproductive endocrinologists in a city as there would be primary care doctors or, you know, OBGYNs or people like that. So at least if you get that information from the American Society for Reproductive Medicine website, you'll at least have a starting point.
So in their bio, you should be able to see very clearly, they did OBGYN residency at this place. They did reproductive endocrinology and infertility fellowship at this place. They were board certified in OBGYN and REI at this point in their career. So those are all things that any boarded REI will have. And that's really kind of the minimum that you need from someone. And you don't necessarily need a whole lot more beyond that, but for pure credentialing to make sure they got the training that you think they got, that's what you're looking for. They should be an MD or a DO. And that means that those are the people who have access to all of the treatments like inseminations, like IVF, like the advanced laboratory techniques, all of that. So it's different than acupuncture and naturopathic medicine and all of those types of things. It's different than what just a general OBGYN can do. And there's variations and gradations, all of that. So that's part of the training that we get that's important to look for when you want to go to somebody who's got all those credentials. So once you've found somebody who's got the actual credentials, how do you know if they're any good?
So that is a little bit of a tricky thing, because statistics out there can be very difficult to interpret. So there are two major places where you can look up IVF statistics. Now, there's nowhere you can look up IUI statistics. Okay, that's just not out there. But when we look at IVF statistics, those statistics are curated through two different entities. One is CDC, Center for Disease Control, and also SART, which stands for, I don't want to mess this one up, so
Society for Assisted Reproductive Technologies.
Good stuff. So
SART.
And so there are places on both of their websites that you can go and look at statistics. And I would say it is probably easier to kind of compare, say, you live in Austin, Texas, okay? And there are, let's say, four major groups in Austin. I'm just making up a number because I'm not thinking of all of them right now. It is easier to go and look at statistics and kind of look at trends between the different groups than looking at one specific statistic themselves, okay? So that's a way to compare. Word of mouth is a big one, okay? And you know, if you have a couple of friends who have gone to somebody and have had success, that's a good sample, you know? But there's more to choosing your REI than just numbers. Okay. Numbers are an important part of it. Absolutely. But sometimes it's how you end up feeling when you go and meet that REI. Okay. There are, some people that are very touchy feely and all that type of thing. Some people are more direct and some people are in between. Okay. And those things, different people need and want different things. So the one thing that I always say is there's an REI out there for you. Okay. But sometimes when you're looking for that personality, you may have to look a little bit to figure out, is this person going to be the right match? And it's okay if you're not, okay? But, you know, it's something to consider.
One thing to think about with the numbers, as Susan said, numbers aren't everything. And it is very easy to get confused in the numbers, and it's very easy for the numbers to be manipulated in a way that makes somebody look better, worse, or in between. And so looking at trends is helpful. Knowing that everybody has to report to the CDC. Some people report to the CDC through SART, but your clinic should have something on the CDC's website. And if they don't, consider why they are not reporting to the CDC, because that's mandated for all of us. And so, like we said, a lot will go through SART, but there's different ways that the CDC and SART both report their statistics. And there are some things in there that when you look at it from the perspective of a patient, you're going like, oh my God, that clinic sucks. And this one is awesome. And in reality, there may be things that those respective clinics are doing that change those numbers. For example, if you have a clinic that is cherry picking their patients, meaning they'll take people who are 42, but the only 42-year-olds that they will even touch for IVF are the ones who have the amazing out of this world egg reserve numbers versus the clinic that will take anybody who walks through the door,
right,
cancel them and say, look, your chances are low, but if you want to do this, let's give it a shot. I'm with you. Those numbers will hit very differently, but the way that those clinics practice will also be very different. And And you may realize one of them, like, oh, they won't even touch me because my numbers are not good and it's going to ruin their statistics. So they're not even going to go there. So they don't take the hard cases.
So I would say in general, if the numbers seem too real, too good to be
good to be real,
there is probably a story behind them. Okay. Like, I think we're all probably thinking of one particular place that we all know that nationally is like the place to go if you are older and this type of thing, exactly as Carrie was describing. But from the inside, we know that there are the people who only allow a very small proportion of people to go through using their own eggs. And if you don't fit certain qualities, you are going to be recommended. Essentially, they'd say you can use donor eggs or you can't be part of our program. And it's true. I actually called this place when I was trying to do fertility myself. And that's what they told me.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And I would say, you know, IVF is not the only service we provide. And I think sometimes it may just be a good idea for you to schedule an appointment with the doctor. Just see how you feel with the doctor. See how they make you feel. See if it's a place that you think you can fit in. And, you know, maybe IVF may be on your horizon. Maybe it might not be because there are other treatments that we do. And so I think the best way to really know what's going to work for you is just schedule an appointment. See how you feel. See what the communication is between you and the nursing staff and you and the physician. And you know, just see if it's a place you think that you would fit in well when you go there.
So one of the kind of bright things of what COVID-19 brought around was telemedicine.
And that's a good thought. So I
think that actually opened up the world for a lot of people who previously didn't have access to fertility care. And so if you have, you know, if you're in an area that is more remote and you don't have a fertility doctor that's super close or something like that, ask about telemedicine visits. More and more places do. I mean, not every fertility doctor does telemedicine. Some people do more than others. But that's another option to help you be able to gain access to more individuals.
And for a lot of us who do a lot of telemedicine, we know how to work the system to figure out, all right, this is what I can do for you from a distance. This is what you need to work with your local OBGYN for. And usually most people have a local doc that's more than willing to help them get through this from a distance. And so, you know, telemedicine is super, super helpful. Now, let's say you go to see someone and they're fine, but they're not the right fit for you. How do you go about a second opinion?
Well, I mean, it's pretty easy. I mean, it's not like you have to get permission from the doctor you've already seen. If you just don't like the doctor you've seen or you want to check things out somewhere else, just schedule another appointment there. You don't honestly have to tell the other doctor that you've been somewhere else. Although generally we ask a lot of probing questions and we eventually figure it out. We're like, now, how did you get that IUI done then? Who did you see for that? So we'll eventually figure it out. And it's okay to say, you know, I just met this doctor. I didn't fit with them. I'm just checking out to see if this is a good fit for me. And I think the only way you really know is if you talk to the people and you have access to their practice and you see how they function.
So another thing to know is also if you want a second opinion, you don't necessarily have to leave that practice. So we all have different personalities. And so if you're changing because, you know, you like the general practice, like the staff and everybody else is fine, you're just like, maybe I will, you know, mesh better with Dr. So-and-so, because I've heard certain things about that person. Usually within clinics, you'll be able to potentially get a second opinion or switch to another doctor. Now, a lot of clinics don't let you do that multiple times. They allow it one time within the practice, you know, to provide for this type of situation. But like I said, just because, you know, if I have plenty of people who are like, you know, I hear what you're saying. I just need to hear this from other people too, you know, and they'll be like, who do you recommend for me to go see? And I'll, you know, I'm like, well, if you're comfortable seeing somebody within the practice, you know, here's somebody that you might do well with, or outside of the practice, here is somebody else. Most of us aren't going to be offended. We know that you're dealing with really big decisions at times, and these are very personal decisions. And you know, needing to hear that information from multiple people, it's okay. We understand.
When you're, if you tell your doc, like, let's say you've got a good relationship with your doc and you're like, hey, I just want to go hear it from someone else. Is there someone you recommend? Like Susan said, we're not any, no doc should read you the riot act for wanting to go talk to someone else. We totally get it. But if you say, oh yeah, I really want to go see Dr. X, and they kind of hold their lips in for a minute. what they're trying to figure out is how to, you know, pretty much all of
nicely
us
are, say, are, don't go there.
we are not going to pan another REI, but we may say, oh, have you heard about Dr. Y? And when we are saying that, we are very politely telling you, don't do it, go somewhere else. Like, cause we all, it's a very small community. Everybody yes. knows who's doing the right thing and who's perhaps making alternative decisions. And we want you to be in good hands, even if they're not our hands. Uh-huh. And so if your doc kind of very politely says, oh, well, what about this place? Or, you know, my partner is really good at this. Like, they're very politely trying to tell you, hey, maybe don't go there because that's not a great place for you. Or for anybody.
For anybody. And,
but I know very few REIs. I know very few doctors in general who will outwardly pan someone else, but they will try and steer you away. You know, oftentimes the staff at the centers, they can tell just by talking to you, like, oh, you're going to be a really good fit for this doc. And it doesn't mean that the other doc in the practice is bad. It just means they're used to dealing with people and they can see by what questions you're asking and how you're doing it, like, oh, you're going to fit in well with that one, but maybe not that one. Even if the skill is the same, the temperament is different.
It's the same thing we do when people finish care with us and they may not have an OB-GYN and they're like, who do you think I should see? If I recommend a specific doctor, it's not because I necessarily think the other doctors aren't good. It's right. just we've gotten to know you through your fertility treatments and we know the different personalities of doctors and we're like, oh, I think this will be a good match. We're matchmakers.
It's true. We totally are. All right. What other big things are important in choosing REIs? Is there anything that I left out that I forgot? We talked about training. Yeah. We talked about the difference between us and other specialties and kind of how to go about a second opinion. Any other big stuff that I missed?
I don't think so.
Know that you're going to have to go see these people in person periodically.
Eventually.
Eventually. You know, I do a lot of telemedicine as well as Carrie. Abby, how much do you do?
Oh, I do a lot.
Yeah.
About every day I'm in the office.
We all live in areas that people travel a lot to.
Yes.
And sometimes, you know, patients are... They're very appreciative of the telemedicine, but when we're like, we need you to come in to have the testing done or something like this that has to be done in person, we understand that it's inconvenient, and we're trying to minimize it as much as possible. And if there's something specific we need to work around, let us know. Okay, but going to your fertility doctor is not like doing telemedicine with say your family medicine doctor, you know, because a lot of times they can do almost everything just talking like we're talking over, you know, Zoom or YouTube or, you know, whatever you're doing. And so you're going to have to go in to see them periodically. So if you are traveling, make sure you're looking to travel at a place that is as convenient as possible or that it's going to be a reasonable thing for you.
Perfect. All right. Well, it was lovely to see you girls tonight, in addition to make a new episode to our audience. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for more. Be sure to subscribe. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. Hop on by, leave us a like or a follow or say hello. If you need to resubscribe, please do that. Apple changes their paradigm all the time. And so we don't want you to miss out on a single hot minute with us.
Hot minute with us. That's right. So you can also visit us on fertility.uncensored.com to submit specific questions, and all questions will be answered on our Ask the Doc segment. Leave us episode ideas. We are always trying to think of what we're going to do for our next episode. So we would love to hear your ideas. Don't hold back, and we'll see you soon.
As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right, we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Did you know 64% of employers added a family building benefit because an employee asked for it? No matter the size of your organization, you have the power to make a difference for current and future employees. Want to know where to start? Progyny is here to help. Progyny is a family building benefits company that has been helping employees and employers advocate for increased access to effective and equitable fertility and family building benefits for over 7 years. To get the resources that can help you make a difference, visit progyny.com/talktohr today. Fertility is complex, and while there's a lot we can't control in the journey to parenthood, nutrition is a big one that both partners can. This is why we've teamed up with Needed, a perinatal nutrition company that optimizes nutrition for both partners throughout all stages of pregnancy. They offer a variety of products to support women and their partners on their journey to conception, including their fertility support for two plan. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off with your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.